Welcome to our special holiday episode, all about pairing mead and food with Chrissy Mannion-Zerriport, author of The Art of Mead Tasting and Food Pairing.
Chrissy is an old friend, and we'll get to know her better, get an overview of her experience in mead, dive into her book.
And we'll get into the key philosophies from the book with specific examples.
As well as how to put together a successful mead and food pairing.
In addition to an overview of the mead industry in the U.S. and its evolution.
This episode is going to be a great resource as you envision and plan how to celebrate the holidays with loved ones and mead.
Thanks for being here and enjoy.
All right. Well, welcome everybody to our holiday podcast. We've got a great guest for you today. And Kendra and I are recording with Chrissy Mannion-Zerriport, the author of The Art of Mead Tasting and Food Pairing. Yeah, welcome, Chrissy. So stoked to have you.
Thanks really much for having me. Nice to meet you, Kendra. And Frank, always a pleasure to hang out with you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Well, I remember when we first met at the Mazer Cup. When was that? Back in 2010?
Oh, I remember too. Yeah, it's been a long time now.
Yeah.
10, 12 years ago, something like that. Yeah.
And you poured me some of your delightful hyper locally produced traditional sweet mead, barrel aged, I believe. And my mind was just blown that.
Well, I still remember you poured me some of your hyper local mead, and it was an orange blossom mead, and it had this pretty art on the bottle of oranges in bloom and oranges in fruit, and it was just divine.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we really connected in that moment, and it's been quite a friendship since. A lot of things have happened in the mead industry, and one of the things that happened that I think really evolved it was the publishing of your book, The Art of Mead Tasting and Food Pairing, which you published in 2017, and it is such a treasure of so many resources for the mead enthusiast. And, you know, I know that the physical product had one print run, and there are copies around. I was looking online, and it looks like you can still get a physical copy of the book, which is great. There's also the digital version, which is available on the Mead Institute's website. And
that's exclusive. So that is the only place you can buy the ebook,
which is pretty awesome. And this book is so incredible because it doesn't just go through what you can do with mead and food, which in and of itself is incredibly valuable, but it also goes through the history of mead, the styles of mead, profiles on different meaderies and their meads, and then recommended pairings. Short of Schramm's book, The Complete Mead Maker, I think this is the most valuable, you know, and that's for people who want to make their own mead. But if you only own one mead book and you are not a mead maker, I think this is the book to own because it goes through everything. So
beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. That's always what it was intended to be, because there just wasn't anything out there for the mead enthusiast. There were, you know, as you know, just a few books for mead makers, but not everybody wants to make mead, you know? Some people just want to enjoy it.
Right. And it's such a huge category, and there's so many things that you can do with it. Sometimes people's heads spin when they encounter mead for the first time and all of its breadth and all of its styles and all of the things you can do with it. So I think that this book is a really valuable guide through that mead universe. And so, Chrissy, before we get much deeper into it, would you give us an introduction of who you are and all the things that you've done in your life? That might take a while. Maybe a quick introduction on all the things you've done, and then a bit of a deeper dive into the mead world.
Well, I grew up in a little tiny town in central Illinois, which is relevant to the mead book only because, I'm 59 years old. I graduated from high school in 1982. I'm of a particular generation of mead makers. And I think how I first heard about mead is pretty typical of people my age, because there was no Harry Potter and there were no video games at all of any kind, really. So, you know, the younger generation seems to get introduced through those avenues and through Game of Thrones and some of these things, but none of that was around. So the first time I ever heard the word mead was in high school English class when we were forced to read Beowulf. So anyway, grew up in a small town in Illinois, and the book is actually dedicated to my high school English teacher because he was the first person who ever said the word mead to me.
Oh, wow. That's very cool.
Really special teacher, and he's no longer with us, so I'm hoping he's up in Valhalla enjoying mead and playing the harmonica.
Oh, that's so awesome. Yeah, I mean, it's literally mentioned in the first stanza.
Yeah, and I was the geek who really got into Beowulf. So Mr. Seidel, that was his name, let me go off and do a special project just researching mead. And there was like nothing to find in those days, but I tried hard and wrote a little like 2-page essay about mead, which mostly was about my ambition to taste some someday. And you know, in 1982, of course, I've done the research since, it was a stupid 16-year-old then, but there were only 25 commercial meaderies in the United States in 1982. Most of them were wineries making mead as a side project. But literally only 25, so not even one in every state.
Wow.
And there essentially was no commercial mead in the United States.
Wow.
I was becoming a young adult. And so my quest for mead, which was always there, took about 15 years until I found myself in a winery in California, and just happened to fall into the winery that made Chaucer's mead. It was just like complete blind, dumb luck. I didn't even know that that's where it was made. And there it was, mead on the shelf. So
wow,
that was,
that is so serendipitous. I love that.
Yeah, so that was my path to mead. I had always had in my mind that mead tasted a little stronger and brighter than Chaucer's, like maybe more like something more like Drambuie, like, you know, strong. And so then a few years later, when I was done with my physics degree and moved to Oregon to take a job as a process engineer at Intel Corporation, I just, again, accidentally wandered into the homebrew supply shop in my neighborhood because, you know, Oregon, there's a homebrew supply store everywhere, even then 30 years ago. And I asked if he knew where I could, I mean, we just had a little conversation, and I asked him if he knew where I could buy good commercial mead. And he said, basically, there isn't any. If you want good mead, you have to make it yourself.
Nice.
So I did. So I walked the rest of the way home with a carboy on my shoulder and a big shopping bag full of hooch, and set up my little meadery in the garage and started making homebrew. And that was about 1996-ish. And, you know, put in several years at Intel as a process engineer and engineering manager. And then my husband and I started Cuckoo Lawn Farms in Oregon. Mostly we did animal protein stuff, grass-fed beef, grass-fed lamb, pastured chicken, pastured eggs, that kind of stuff.
Beautiful.
But I had this little ambition on the side. And so gradually opened a teeny, got all the licensing. My first commercial batch of mead was 13 gallons.
Oh.
And, you know, I never really had an ambition to have just a meadery that would be my bread and butter to support me. That was never the goal. But rather than being an expensive hobby, I thought maybe it could be like a break-even side hustle. And we were always direct to consumer for our farm products. And so it was just natural that it was farm to consumer for the mead also. And we had the farm for almost 18 years.
Wow.
Just sold the farm and retired about 6 months ago.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so amazing. Congratulations.
Right. So my very last batch of commercial mead is still out there. There's a little local grocery store in Oregon called Market of Choice. Most of the stores are in Portland, but there's one in Salem and one in Ashland. And
wow. So you also were involved in founding the AMMA and in being the director of legislative affairs and the AMMA Meadmakers Journal. So I don't think you touched on those, but is there anything you want to say about those experiences? Because I think one of the things we'd love to share with our audience is kind of how you've been involved in helping the meat industry grow and how your perspective on it is really valuable and can help us all help it grow by gaining from your perspective that knowledge.
Thanks. Well, I just went to the Maser Cup and had no experience judging, no training judging, and just volunteered to be a table steward. And then Ken Schramm was there, and they asked, you know, does anybody want to sit at the table with Ken Schramm? And, you know, I'm old enough that I don't really care if I look overeager. And I was always the geek in the front row with my hand up anyway. So, like, as soon as the sentence mouth, my hand went up. And I got to sit at the table with Ken Schramm that day. And so we had some conversations. I sat with him and a few other people at lunch. And we got talking about mead as a paleo alcohol, right? Paleo diets were just kind of coming into vogue and they were very anti-alcohol. And it's like, well, if you were paleo, you were drinking every chance you got. And it was mead because there wasn't agriculture, so it wasn't wine or beer, right? And so we played around with the idea of like writing an article together about mead as the paleo alcohol and authentically paleo. That never came to fruition because Ken said he thought that the legislative stuff was the most important issue in front of the mead industry and he didn't have the bandwidth to do it. I said I would.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I became the legislative chair. I just volunteered to do it because Ken said it was important. So I just trusted and jumped. And, you know, it was good, right? Like there was no organization around the mead industry asking for legislative progress. And the laws at the time were just incredibly archaic. Mead was defined by the TTB very narrowly. And so if you're mead, and like we all know now what a wonderful, wild, diverse, you know, broad spectrum of products can fall under the umbrella of mead. Like if you didn't fit their narrow definition, you couldn't put the word mead on your bottle.
Right.
And I think Ken said this particularly well when we visited the TTB in Washington. He said, you know, we're trying to launch a mead industry. Consumers haven't even heard of mead. And we can't even put the word mead on the bottle. You're making this hard. So we got the definition broadened. That was a big win.
Totally.
We also got involved with a marketing committee. And that too is part of how the book came together because we were trying to brainstorm like from a marketing perspective, what would be the best things that could fall out of the air for the meat industry since we don't have any budget at all to do anything ourselves, right? So the movie Beowulf with Angelina Jolie had just come out, but you know, there were no product placements in that, and they didn't really talk about mead very much in the movie. But wouldn't it be cool if like a movie came out with a mead product placement in it? Not necessarily a brand name, but just like mead. Or wouldn't it be awesome if one of the big breweries like Budweiser came out with mead and did a Super Bowl ad and like told the world what mead is? Because nobody in the mead industry could afford a Super Bowl ad. Or what if somebody wrote a book about mead or about like pairing food with mead, like for a book for consumers? And we kind of played with the idea. And so I just sort of, you know, little red hen syndrome or something. I just I do it myself. But being involved with the AMMA was terrific. There were about maybe 250 meaderies in the US at that time. And I pretty much was on a first name basis with every mead owner in the country at that point. I knew where, I mean, I could tell you off the cuff from memory what each meadery's name was, who the owner or the head mead maker was, what city they were in. I knew it all cold, but then all of a sudden the industry started growing and it was too hard to keep up with.
Right. And that was kind of about the time your book was published, right?
Yeah. And it was really special to be involved with the legislative effort and the marketing effort, you know, and just all of the startup crew right at the time that the mead industry literally exploded. Because during the time I was writing the book, the number of meaderies went from about 250 to 400.
Wow. And
I don't even know what the number is now. Do you, Frank?
It's been a little bit. I know Greg at AMMA is trying to get his arms around that question again. And they've got some plans for this next year to try to answer that question a little bit more solidly. But I can't tell you. And I don't know if Greg can right now.
Wouldn't surprise me if it was over 1,000.
Right. I mean, I think COVID hit the brakes on a lot of people's plans to launch. But we do custom crush here at Golden Coast Mead. And in the last couple of weeks, we've gotten a lot of inquiries into whether we can support folks. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the trajectory of the industry is. And I think that your book is such a great introduction to the category for so many people. And, you know, I'm hearing you say that the book needed to be written, right? That there was this awareness that navigating the category had not yet been done. And
I was hearing a lot of questions in my own tasting room.
Because you owned your bottle shop, right?
Yeah, because in those days I didn't just make my own mead and sell it. I had a little bottle shop and I had about 120 different commercial meads from all over the country and some from abroad. And so, you know, people would come into the tasting room and they'd be asking, now mead, that was what Vikings drank, right? I mean, all the stereotypical questions. And I found myself giving the same answer over and over and over. And as I was talking with other mead makers, of course, they were answering the same questions I was hearing over and over and over. And then as the number of meaderies was increasing, and the meaderies that existed were growing, there was this problem of training employees because there was no training material. And I mean, really, I felt like I had a genie on my shoulder dictating the book to me. I mean, it was the strangest thing. It wasn't like an ambition. I had never wanted to write a book. But like it was dragged out of me. I was just compelled to write it. I mean, it really was like you hear about like genies and muses and inspiration and all this stuff. Like I just had to get it written. It almost wrote itself.
Wild.
Well, we're grateful for that genie of yours.
And I have heard of other authors saying that, and that they even like will talk about book ideas together. I think it was Ann Patchett and Barbara Kingsolver or something, were sitting at lunch and one of them was like, this idea just keeps coming up to me and I don't have time for it. And then the other author's like, well, can I run with it? And then the other gets the permission of the first. And then the whole novel materializes almost the same way that it was being presented to the first author. So anyways, little anecdote around that. And thank you for being the person that did the work, because it is a lot of work. It's like 400 and, well, let's see here, 413 pages with multiple indexes, including a whole foods index. And I think, you know, that's a big part of the book that we want to get into. In our last podcast episode, we talked about hosting with Mead, and about these two major concepts that I remember from when you came out to Golden Coast Mead and you presented on how to work with Mead in your food. And to have you on here today to talk more about those concepts and cover the stuff that I missed. I mean, the two main ideas that we brought up were match and amplify, and then complement and contrast. But
yeah,
you know, those are really basic ideas. And if you have more to share with our audience, I think that'd be super valuable. And how you approach thinking about the mead you're working with and how you're going to pair it with a meal, or the cuisine that you're working with and how you're going to find a mead that's going to work. What do you like to teach your audience?
Oh no, what am I going to cook for dinner?
Mm-hmm.
So like one tip, and I know this sounds like upselling and I really don't mean it this way, but like when you've gone to a meadery and you're tasting the mead and you're like, oh, I love this, I want this one, never buy just one bottle. Go for three at least, because you love the mead, right? You know you love it because you decided to buy it. So if you just buy one bottle, you go home, you haven't made any notes because nobody ever takes notes. And several weeks or months go by, and now you're like, oh, this was really good, I want to share it with my friend Rhonda, but I don't remember what it tasted like. I wonder what I should cook. So like, you're doubly handicapped here. If you buy three bottles, then when you go home and you're getting ready to cook dinner, plan dinner, you can open one of those bottles and pour yourself a little taste and remember what it tasted like and make some notes about what flavors you detect and do a little planning for how to match the food. And then you've got one open bottle. And if the dinner is just the next night or a couple nights later, usually that open bottle will serve just fine. But if your guests love it, you want to have another bottle in the wings ready to open up.
Mm.
Not like, oh, sorry, it's gone. We'll just have to that I have in the refrigerator. So always go for at least three. That way you've got a bottle that you can do your planning with.
I love that. That advice should be in every meadery's tasting room, you know?
Yeah, it just sounds insincere when it's in the tasting room, and it really isn't. I mean, really, if you decide you like the mead, buy three because, right? Just because.
Yeah, one for remembering what it was like, and then two for the dinner party you're going to host with it. Yeah.
And then like maybe the dinner party is a big success and you're like, whoa, that was really good last week. Too bad it's all gone. I wish I had some to drink now. So like get three. Okay. So you've got your three bottles of mead at home and you've opened the bottle that you bought several weeks ago at Frank's place and you pour a little in a glass and you're tasting it. And then you want to try to decide like, what are the characteristics of this mead so I can plan the food? So really the first thing is the intensity. So mead can be really intense or really subtle. And it can be intense because it's got a lot of alcohol, or because it's got a lot of sugar, or because it's got a lot of spices, or because it's just got the flavors saturated. But when you've got a big, intense mead, you better have some big, intense food or there's going to be a drastic mismatch. So that's the first thing I would look at. It's like if the mead's big, the food has to be big. If the mead is really light and fresh and subtle, then the food also has to be very light and subtle, because otherwise it'll overwhelm the mead. So that's the first thing.
Hey, Regenerates. Stay tuned for part two after this quick break.
3 bottles of mead for $115 and free shipping. You have the chance to upcycle your drinking life and replace that monoculture-based beverage you currently go to. Mead, as you know, is made from honey. And these meads are made from regenerative organic honey sourced from the wild forests of Brazil. Friend of the pod, Chrissy Mannion-Zarapour, recommends keeping at least 3 bottles of mead on hand. And these 3 meads, Wildflower Sour, Wildflower Sweet, and Wildflower Dry, are beautiful meads that are sure to fit in anywhere libations are enjoyed. We're willing to bet we'll light up your life with these unique meads. After all, the bees visit 10,000 flowers to make the honey in just one sip. Right now, you can order the Regenerative Mead Sampler at goldencoastmead.com/shop and get all these meads shipped directly to your front door. Please see our website in the show notes for more details and order your Regenerative Mead Sampler today. Cheers!
The second thing is whether the mead is very sweet or very dry, or now that there are so many capsomels made with chili peppers, very hot or spicy. So if the mead is very sweet, either your dinner has to be pretty spicy, and I'm thinking like Indian food, Mexican food, especially Indian food, because those aromatic spices pair really well with the sweetness of the mead.
Nice.
Or if the mead's very sweet, your other option is to just push that off to dessert. Okay. Because a sweet mead will usually go well with dessert. But that's the expected pairing, right? I think it's a lot more interesting to go with big, spicy food. And
I remember you cautioning about alcohol too, right? With spicy foods and high alcohol meads, there's a word of caution there. And sorry to derail you, but I want to make sure we touch on that, because that was pretty revelatory when I read that piece.
Absolutely right. And so a big sweet mead will go great with spicy food, but a high alcohol mead won't. When you've got spicy food, and I'm thinking about, you know, just big, hot, spicy food. I don't know, harissa sauce that burns your mouth, or, you know, tacos with lots of chili peppers in them, or anything that's got a lot of hot spices in it. That's where you really want the sweet mead. The high alcohol meads will not work for that. Better for high alcohol meads is to go high fat in your food. Wonderful. And even a little bit of sweetness. Because the high alcohol gets perceived as heat. And if you're trying to drink like a 14% or 16% or 18% not sweet mead with a spicy hot meal, it's not going to be fun.
Wow. Yeah. But like a mole and pork or something that's going to round out, right?
Yeah. Rich, high fat, slightly sweet things. Pork is a little bit sweet. Lamb that's high fat can often be perceived as a little bit sweet. Some seafood like salmon, for instance, can be, or tuna can be very fatty and rich. And you really need something to cut through all that fat to complement it. Wow. But you don't want to make it hot and spicy at the same time if it's a high alcohol meat.
Right. Almost like a sashimi tuna with like a higher ABV floral meat. That could be pretty divine.
Oh, man. Let's put it in.
Okay. So I derailed you and I apologize for that, but we did touch some beautiful moments there. Do you want to get back to where you were? Sorry.
So intensity would be the first thing I'd look at.
Right.
Another fun thing to look at is like, where does the mead come from? Or where does the tradition of this mead come from? So.
Ethiopian food.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess I need to I guess, I mean, you've been doing this podcast for a while, so I think most of your listeners are up to speed on this, but just in case for somebody new, like Mead is not just Ethiopian Tej and is not just for Vikings. Whoever you are and wherever your ancestors were on the planet, they made mead at some point in your ancestral past, because bees are everywhere from the equator to the Arctic Circle. And before there were vineyards and grain fields and fields of hops, the only alcohol that was available was alcohol from honey. It's still the most sugar dense agricultural product that there is. So it's the easiest thing to make alcohol from because there's so much sugar. So, you know, you can look at Ethiopian traditions of making mead or Polish traditions of making mead, but there are also Spanish and Italian and French and Scottish traditions for making mead, and not just Europe. Even the Native Americans in the North and South American continents made some alcohols from honey, also from corn. Archaeological evidence that we have, like hard archaeological evidence, is actually from northern China. So even in Asia, there's clear evidence of having made mead in the past. And in fact, the word mead is cognate with the Hindi word madhu for honey. So it's such an old word that it predates all the Indo-European languages splitting. And India, in fact, has the oldest written reference to mead in the Rig Veda book. So it's authentically Indian, it's authentically Asian, it's authentically African, it's authentically American, certainly authentically European. And so you can start with the style of mead. So if you're working with, say, a Slavic style mead that's, you don't really know, but like somewhere around Polish or Russian or something, then try using Polish or Russian food to pair with the mead. Or if you're working with a Tej, try making Ethiopian or even West African food to go with the mead. Mm-hmm. If you're working with an Irish mead, try working with lamb or seafood, because those are the traditional staples in Ireland, right? So be inspired by where the style of mead originated. That could be a lot of fun.
That could be so much fun.
Yeah. Mm.
And whether you're exploring, you know, some of your own ancestral, you know, ties or not, I mean, just tapping into something that is so universally human, it never ceases to kind of give me goosebumps when it comes to mead.
It always gives me goosebumps. That to me was one of the most compelling things about mead when I first learned it. Like, you know, wine was a little too, I mean, my own background includes French, but wine was a little too French and a little too pretentious 40 years ago, right? Not so much now. And beer was just starting to become a thing. I mean, when I moved to Portland in 1996, there were no restaurants that served artisanal brews. They really just started coming into existence in 1998. So like mead had this universal appeal that like it belongs to everybody, and it makes us all human, and it's this just beautiful unifying thing that doesn't separate us.
Awesome. I love that.
Yeah. And the art of entertaining is, I think, a gift that we get to explore as we age. You know, Ken and Allison Schramm hosted the U.S. Mead Open back in May, and they got Chef Jimmy Schmidt, a Michelin star winning chef from Detroit, to do a mead and food pairing. And you know, it's not every day that someone gets to have a dinner from a Michelin chef, starred chef, but he drank the meads and he tasted. And when he presented his pairings, he said, I was looking for what these meads were speaking to me. And he then proceeded to break down each mead and give these quick notes about what the mead was about and what characteristics the meads had that he then used as kind of, you know, like a scatter graph or a mind map. And here's mead A, and it has characteristics 1, 2, and 3. And I'm going to come up with a dish that takes those characteristics and complements them and allows the dish and the mead to kind of amplify each other. And, you know, this is what you're saying is doing this. And your book then goes into specific recipes. How many recipes are in this book?
I don't remember.
Like almost 100, right?
Gives you the resources as a non-Michelin starred chef at home to you know, have a crack at making some good pairings.
Yeah. So I cooked every recipe in this book, and I personally edited every recipe in this book. And in many cases, I would take 3 or 4 recipes for something and tweak it a little bit to make it more mead friendly. Like, I don't know, savory Chinese beef short ribs, right? So it's a very high fat, very sweet main dish. And instead of using sugar or rice wine in preparing the short ribs, I used honey and mead to just amplify those honey flavors more.
Okay.
But all of these recipes work and all of these pairings work because I did them myself.
I wouldn't expect anything less, Chrissy.
and you can do the same thing. So like, I don't know, if you decide you want to pair a mead with, how about avocado toast? That wasn't a thing in 2017. Toast. But it makes a great brunch, right?
Right.
So like one thing is you can choose a bread that's more honey friendly, that mm-hmm. like has aromas in it that are friendly to honey.
Wow.
Right? Do you see what I'm saying? So like, mm-hmm. and especially if you're baking your own bread, you know, you could make like a wheat bread that had a little honey in it. So it had some aromas of honey.
Wonderful. Yeah.
And I like to use seasoning salt. I mean, any of them, like Red Robin seasoning salt or Lawry's seasoning salt, they're all pretty similar. But they have a lot of aromatic spices in them. And those aromatic spices go beautifully with honey or with mead. And so you just get this extra pop when you use seasoning salt instead of plain salt. And then avocados, of course, are very high fat. So you can pair it with, even though it's a delicate flavor, you can pair it with a little bit more intense mead than you think you can, because mm-hmm. you can get away with it due to the fat.
Right. And the perceived sweetness of the avocado can kind of play with that. Oh, wow. Yeah. So the creativity that's available to us when we start to think with these big blocks, right? You've got intensity, you've got aroma, you've got sweetness. And then you think about the foods that are going to be paired and how they have their own intensity and aroma and sweetness. And can these blocks fit together? And when they go into your guest's mouth at the same time, is that going to create a pleasant, you know, almost attention grabbing experience, right? I think of it as success when my guests are no longer talking to each other, just attending to the sensations in their mouth.
Yeah, when their minds are blown and they can only taste. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, COVID brought a lot of takeout culture, right? Mm. And a lot of takeout food. And it's a real pleasure to have things delivered to your house. Like now that I don't live in a town of 900 people in the middle of nowhere, it's wonderful to actually order something, have it just come to your house. It blew my mind. Anyway, there's like all these spicy and ethnic foods, right? So like you can get Filipino food delivered to your door or Ethiopian food delivered to your door or whatever, right? So these spicy things that tend to make good takeout food are a lot better with mead than they are with wine or beer. And I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. Most beer is made with hops. In fact, in Germany, it's required to be made with hops. In the US, I don't know, there's some other bittering agents and other aromatic agents, and some people play with other things. But in general, beer is always made with hops, which always introduces bitterness. And bitterness with hot and spicy does not play well together in the same sandbox. So that's, I mean, it's true. You can get something, you know, light and fresh and almost sweet like a Pilsner that can, if it's not too high in alcohol, can work with spicy food. It's not impossible to do, but you've always got that bitterness that doesn't like hot and spicy.
Yeah, a Mexican lager. And, yeah, these are very low flavor, low intensity drinks.
Yeah, right? I mean, there's nothing really interesting about it. It's just refreshing, right? That's about all you can say about it. And then you, even though the flavors are big, you know, you might want to pair with a red wine because the flavors are big. But red wines have all these tannins in them, which again are bitter, bitter and astringent. And there are certainly exceptions, and there are beautiful red wines that can pair with spicy food. So it's not 100%, but in general, you are not going to have success pairing a red wine with spicy food because it tends to be dry and it tends to be higher alcohol, mm-hmm. and it tends to have all these tannins that introduce this bitter component. In general, a sweeter white or rosé wine, or even better, a mead, not too dry, but, you know, this is where those semi-sweet and sweet meads really come into their own. Jeff Herbert at Superstition Mead said this in a very memorable take-home way for me. Hmm. People think they don't like sweet wines, right? It's not fashionable to think you like sweet wines. But he says, it's just people lying to themselves, because everybody loves a burger and a Coke, and a Coke is sweet.
Very true.
Right? So it's not the sweetness. It's what people really don't like is a sweet wine or mead that's not well made. And if it's cloyingly sweet and not balanced with good acid and you know, good architecture under the sweetness, it's not going to be enjoyable no matter what. But if you've got a well-made, well-balanced, sweet mead, you absolutely can pair it with a main dish.
Nice.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And Indian food, Thai food, Chinese food. There's so many, yeah, Western African food. Like, there's so many cuisines that have rich spices, some fat to them, and could work just so well with meat. And I think, you know, industry-wise, this is the Regenerative Mead podcast. So we talk a lot about the regenerative aspects of mead and not so much about the business. But one thing, you know, running a meadery for 13 years, and you ran a mead shop and a meadery for years, I think one thing we've run into is finding a common language and working with business owners who run these kinds of restaurants to find a model that works for both sides. And I think that the education piece and the consumer demand piece are two pieces that have been missing. And so I'm just wondering, as you look at the mead landscape over the decades you've been involved, what have you seen change since the book has been published? And what are your hopes for the future?
Well, I have definitely seen the number of meaderies increase, which is awesome. I have seen the first question out of a consumer or potential consumer's mouth shift. It used to be, what is mead anyway? Or mead was what the Vikings drank, right? to now they say, oh, mead, I had that once. It was okay. Or I had a really good experience, or I had a really bad experience. But like, they've heard of it and they've tried it. That's huge, right?
Nice.
Huge.
Because we used to have to tell people what the thing was and persuade them to put the first sip in their mouth, and then they would like it. Now, like, they already know what it is and they've already tried it once. And we don't have to do all that work as meadery owners anymore. So that's a huge difference. It's not where I would like to see it, and I think this is where the future is. But I have finally had the experience several times of being in a restaurant and seeing mead on the menu.
Right.
And that's pretty cool.
Time. And even if I don't feel like drinking, I always order mead if I see it on the menu.
You gotta let them know the demand is there.
Yeah, that's right.
So you can vote, right? And for a long time, Frank knows this story. This was like my thing that I did. I would go out to eat and I would ask to see the mead list. And then like the server would look at me like, we don't have a mead list. We have a wine list. And I would say, oh, I thought this was a nice place. Okay. I guess. All right. And I did that for years. Every single time I went to a restaurant, and I encouraged other people to do the same thing. But like the point is, restaurants don't know that consumers want mead with their food unless consumers ask for it, right?
Brilliant.
Oh, Chrissy, I love you.
I love you too.
I hope listeners are taking notes. If anything, just ask for mead. Even if you don't feel like having a glass, just ask.
Yeah. Just ask for it, because it's not going to be on the menu if you don't ask for it. Or like look at the most expensive entree on the menu and say, well, if there was mead, I'd order this. But I do this stuff all the time. I tell you, I constantly, I'm like willing a future into existence where mead is available at any sit down restaurant.
I love that.
And that's how it has to happen.
While you were writing the book, Chrissy, did you have any just exemplary mead and food experiences that are still with you that you'd be willing to share with the audience?
Oh, I had so many, Frank. and they weren't all complicated is the thing. Like, this doesn't have to be big, expensive, complicated, scary. So cheese plates, right? Everybody loves cheese and wine. Well, it turns out everybody loves cheese and mead too, because pretty much any mead is going to be good with some kind of cheese. And there's a section in the book about, and I break down different kinds of cheese and generally what kind of mead to pair with it. But particularly blue cheeses, which can be very polarizing, have historically been served with a side of honey. In the swankiest, fanciest places and in the lowliest places, if you ask for blue cheese, it's likely to be brought with a little pot of honey on the side. Mm. And blue cheese is paired beautifully with meads. And again, blue cheese is a big genre. So there's dry and crumbly blue cheeses, and there's fatty and moist blue cheeses. Mm-hmm. Some of them are fairly subtle. Some of them are huge and aromatic. And it's just fun to play with. But because they're so honey friendly, they're also mead friendly. And I did a cheese plate just playing with this idea that had five different blue cheeses on it. And I think I had about 10 bottles of mead open that night. And it was just nirvana.
Oh, wow.
And I like filled notebook pages with notes, but like the summary was all the combinations were great. Like blue cheese loves mead. And The thing is, you don't have to love blue cheese by itself to love blue cheese with mead, because putting the two together completely transforms each of them. So If you've got a really big, sweet, high alcohol mead, it can be a little overwhelming on its own, right? First of all, it's high alcohol, you're going to get drunk. Second of all, it's so much sugar, such a big sugar load. You really need something that's a complement to it, that's not amplifying and matching, but rather contrasting and complementing, because nobody can have that much alcohol and sugar. Like, we'd be dead, right? but blue cheese is like big and dry and savory and fatty and rich, and it's just the perfect contrast to mead. And yeah. And that blew my mind.
That's wonderful. I have 13, I don't know how long we've been doing this, 13 years. Yeah. And like, there's just a core offering right there. If you want to have an experience that's going to open people's minds, get blue cheese and a mead that works with it, which will probably be most, but a sweet traditional that's well made, and a blue cheese that's funky and complex. And just like, I mean, is this on little toasts? Like, is this on crackers? Is just by the spoonful?
Never, just pick it up with your fingers. But like, if you take, like, if you're going to a brunch party or a Thanksgiving party or a Christmas party where you're supposed to bring something for the buffet, and you bring a mead and blue cheese pairing, like, that's the only thing people will be talking about at the party.
Absolutely.
That's a great recommendation. Thank you, Chrissy. Man.
Another one, I got one yeah. more for you.
Yeah.
The other one that just completely blew my mind, that was it was a little more work, but it's still like peasant food. Was Polish stuffed cabbage rolls. So like an egg roll, right? But like, you're using cabbage leaves instead of the wonton wrapper. And really, like, that whole corner of the world has their own cabbage roll recipe. All of Scandinavia, Russia, Poland, all of the Slovakian countries have cabbage rolls.
Even Romania, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And they can be made with beef or pork or lamb or various meats. And they've got typically sour cream and parsley. They've got some aromatic spices. And they're rich and fatty and comfort food. And they just go terrifically with meads.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Pretty simple to make, right?
Yeah, they're not hard. I mean, you know, it's a little bit of hand labor, but if you got a few people to help you and you pour them a glass of mead, they'll be happy to do it with you.
Okay.
And then they're so delicious and they're so easy, you know, just as a simple take to work thing, like the leftovers keep for many, many days.
Wonderful. And yeah, you've got a whole spread on this process, stuffed cabbage rolls and a whole premise on it as well. I love how you do that, how you lay out the historical precedent and then kind of the philosophical approach and then the practical, this is how you do it, recipe, and rate it by difficulty, and the instructions aren't too complex and the ingredients aren't esoteric. I mean, this is such a wonderful book, Chrissy. It's really a gift to the whole mead community.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you, Frank.
Yeah. Well, We're getting to the point where we should wrap things up, but what core messages would you love for your readers to come away with from this big book, this genie that was on your shoulder coaching through the production of this incredible book?
Really, the book is just all about enabling people to not be intimidated by it. Like, mead is not just for kings. It's not just for Vikings. It's not some weird thing that Harry Potter drinks with his school friends. I mean, those things are okay too. It's also those. But like, there are 1,000 meaderies in the United States making bold, modern, on-trend meads that are just beautiful beverages to pair with food. And it doesn't have to be intimidating. I mean, if you make dinner and this particular mead isn't the best fit, like just open a different bottle of mead. Be experimental, be bold, just try things. Of course, that's a lot easier to do if you have 30 bottles of mead in, on the floor of your pantry, which is something I highly recommend for everybody. But like, just play. It's just a playground. Just play.
Wonderful.
That's fantastic advice, Chrissy.
Yeah. What a gift it is to be with you, Chrissy. So you're not touring with the book anymore, but do you make appearances ever? Is there a way people can follow you, or are you just enjoying retirement and it's up to us to come find you?
Well, it can come find me. I'm not really that hard to find. I don't know. I've got a Facebook page with my name. If somebody really wants to find me, they can certainly do it that way. Okay. You know, I'm around. I don't know. I'm retired, so I'm kind of half the year in the U.S. and half the year in Spain, and I like it that way. I'm not really doing public appearances. Didn't really. I mean, for heaven's sakes, Frank, I'm not like a celebrity or something. I mean, if you ask me, I'll do a podcast with you. And if you invited me to San Diego, I'd probably come. But I don't know. If somebody sends me an email, I'll answer it.
Okay. We've got some listeners in the EU who are launching meteries or running meteries. And, you know, I think that your knowledge is just so wonderful. So I'll leave it to them to pursue you as they see best, and then up to you to follow up as you see best. But maybe there's an opportunity for this knowledge that you have put together and shared with the world to spread globally, which would be a huge boost to the whole industry. So thank you so much, Chrissy, for all your work and bringing all your talents to the mead industry. It has really helped us all grow. Since you've been involved, there have been some huge strides, and I think we're all very grateful for that.
Well, there have been, and you probably get more credit for that than I do. You've just been a wonderful leader in the industry, and your podcast is great. And all the work that you're doing with regenerative beekeeping and mead making and you know, making people aware is wonderful. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you. So thanks so much for the compliment of inviting me.
Our pleasure. And we'll stay in touch and keep each other up to date on the unfolding. But I look forward to testing some of these recipes with my family and friends over this holiday season. And I hope our listeners do the same.
Awesome. I hope you do too.
Right. Happy holidays. Thank you so much, Chrissy.
Yeah. And happy New Year.
Well, that's our episode. If you try any of these pairing ideas or pick up the book and put it to use, please tag Golden Coast Mead when you post about it on social media. We'd love to see it.
Until next time, drink the change you want to see in the world. Cheers.
Cheers.